May it please the court. This case is a fairly simple one factually. It arises from emergency room treatment the plaintiff received for a brown leech spider bite. She was treated on two separate occasions by two independent contractor emergency room physicians. And on those two separate occasions, she signed, prior to treatment, consent forms that in which Baptist, the defendant here, explained to her that the doctors were independent contractors, in layman's language, said that the doctors were not employees at the hospital, and explained that Baptist would not be responsible for any errors in medical judgment or medical treatment.
Doesn't she say she does not remember?
Yes, Your Honor, she says she doesn't remember signing them, but there's been no testimony that she did not sign them. There was no verified pleading signed claiming that she hadn't signed them.
Isn't it strange, though, that if someone comes to an emergency room and has his form placed before them, that seems rather unfortunate in a way that they would be expected, what, to read it and understand it?
Well, Your Honor, I suppose the form could actually be considered as unnecessary because all citizens of Texas are supposed to know the very strong law in Texas that a hospital cannot, absent certain limited circumstances, actually employ a physician to begin with.
Well, isn't that one of these limited circumstances?
No, it's not, Your Honor. This is a general hospital not controlled by physicians, and Baptist could not legally enter into an employer-employee relationship with these emergency physicians.
Could any doctor decide to work a shift in the emergency room? How does that work?
I believe the record reflects that there was a contract between Baptist and a group of emergency room physicians. I'm not sure the record indicates the scheduling. I believe it was scheduled through that group that's responsible for scheduling the emergency room.
The hospital has a contract
with the group
to work in the emergency room.
Well, with the group.
And the hospital has no right or ability to decide that X doctor cannot practice ER medicine at the hospital.
But the physicians have to have privileges there, Your Honor. In other words, they could deny privileges. To a particular physician. But the plain fact of the matter is that the hospital could not legally have an employer-employee relationship with the particular physician at issue. This is not like the situation involving a taxi cab company where you see a taxi cab go by, it's got a yellow cab on it, you hop in it, believe that that you're getting into a cab driven by a yellow cab employee, because yellow cab can actually employ drivers. Now, yellow cab can choose to have an independent contractor relationship with drivers in an attempt to avoid liability. And, you know, there, this doctrine of ostensible agency by estoppel, whatever you want to call it, will come into play. But in a hospital setting, an employee-employer relationship with a physician is simply not possible in the setting. So,
is your argument the same vis-a-vis a resident or a nurse? Isn't it true that the hospital employs residents as actual employees and pays them a salary, and the same thing with nurses?
The statutory schemes governing those two classifications of individuals is different. Nurses, the Nurse Practice Act specifically speaks to employment and obviously allows employment of nurses by hospitals. With respect to residents, they can only practice under an institutional license. They're not fully licensed and are expected to practice under supervision. This is not something on which the court would be writing on a blank slate. Many years ago, this court refused the writ in the case Watt versus, it's cited in my brief, I didn't give you the other name. It's Watt versus Texas State Board of Medical Examiners, in which the Court of Appeals affirmed a revocation of a medical doctor's license because he allowed himself to be employed by a clinic that wasn't controlled by physicians.
And a lot of things have changed in the last 10 years, you know, with the advent of HMOs and all. How does this, it's what you described, the relationship between the ER physician group and HMOs, is that any different? Hospitals run by HMOs?
If the entity that is going to be employing the physician is not completely controlled by a physician. In other words, if it's a corporation that has non-physicians in control of it, then courts of this state have interpreted the Medical Practice Act to preclude that.
What about the new statute about allowing suits against HMO? How do we factor those policies in if we wanted to rethink what we have historically held to be liability of the hospital?
Well, this the
legislature's policy change affect our analysis, or should it?
Now, that statute doesn't apply here because it only applies to managed care entities, of which Baptist is not one.
And makes managed care entities liable for what?
If the managed care entity makes, I believe, certain medical treatment decisions. The problem here is that nothing in the record before this court questions at all any of the case law precluding the relationship that Baptist had, or the relationship that Baptist would be held liable as if it had.
Don't a lot of other states have similar statutes that prohibit doctors from working for a non-medical? I mean, the Texas scheme is not unique.
No, but those statutes have not been enforced as strongly as the one in Texas. There was a law review article written in, I believe, 1987. I don't have the site with me, but I can provide it to the court, in which there was a comparison done of a number of states, and Texas was one of four states only that had a corporate prohibition against the corporate practice of medicine that was as strong. But that's really a side issue in this case. The issue is really whether or not, you know, which test Texas is going to use in a hospital context for this doctrine of ostensible agency.
And under those tests, is not reliance one of the issues?
Only under one of those tests.
Under the one that you're advocating?
Yes, the three-element test that a number of courts of appeals have adopted in the medical malpractice area, a test that is consistent with all of this court's opinions on apparent authority. That test requires that a patient have a reasonable belief.
And in that regard, I'm going to change the facts on you a little bit, but we have to fashion our opinion to fit all fact situations. What about the situation where you have a person sitting at home and they see 4, 5, 6, 7 TV commercials in a matter of a day advocating how Columbia Healthcare is going to take care of you? And then they see a billboard on the highway saying how Columbia Healthcare is going to take care of you. So the person has an ER-type situation, they go to Columbia Healthcare to be taken care of. Why is that not a reliant situation, thinking they're going to go to Columbia to be taken care of by Columbia?
Well, I guess the...
Even if they have these forms when they get there, that they're signed, that most of these people can't read and understand what those forms mean anyway, which I realize legally is no way out. But they tell them clearly, simply, without the legal hodgepodge on TV, we're going to take care of you. Then you get there, just sign this real quick and we'll take care of you. Why can't they think that they are being treated by Columbia Healthcare?
Because in Texas, Columbia Healthcare can't provide that treatment. Now, that's a closer question because there you have conduct that could be misleading. But here there's nothing in the record about any such advertisement with respect to Baptist. And all Baptist is advocating and wants this court to do is apply the three-element test that has been applied for decades in Texas, and that is require that the patient, in a summary judgment context, produce evidence on all three elements, first of which is that the patient had a reasonable belief that the doctor was an employee. Secondly, that belief was generated by a holding out by the hospital that the physician was an employee. And thirdly, that the patient relied on that.
You're not allowed to see a physician until the hospital allows it. Doesn't that give you some sense that the physician is part of the structure there at the hospital?
I don't think that can be assumed. If this court is going to continue with the rule that it has applied in every other context, that citizens of Texas are presumed to know the law, the fact that someone simply assumes an employment relationship isn't enough. And
what was the name of the ER doctor in this case?
Sakula, I believe, Dr. Sakula.
And what if I went in there to the ER and said, I want to see Dr. Sakula? They would tell me I got to fill out all these forms that relate to the hospital before they would even let me pass the gate to see Dr. Sakula. In other words, I can't go in and request a doctor I want to see. I've got to go in there and comply with the hospital's mechanism for me to see any doctor, and it may very well not be Dr. Sakula. It may be whoever is next on the docket.
Well, I don't believe the record reflects all, you know, all of this, so I want to apologize. I'd like to answer your question, but I don't know that it's based on the record. First off, if a patient goes to an emergency room and asks for his private physician, his private physician will be called. So if you ask for Dr. Sakula and Dr. Sakula is there or can be called, nothing would prevent, you know, or keep you from seeing him, assuming he has privileges at that hospital. That form contains other things. It also gives consent for the hospital employees to touch the patient before a patient can be treated and have his blood pressure taken and be treated by the hospital nurses. As in an emergency circumstance, the hospital wants to get that consent to treatment signed. So that tape form is not simply a disclaimer. But it contains that information because of prior cases in the courts of appeals that held that absent notice of this kind, patients could freely assume that the physician was a hospital employee. Although, with this court's prior opinions, again, on the fact that citizens of Texas are presumed to know the law, it is somewhat incredible that absent an affirmative misrepresentation like advertisements, et cetera, whether such a belief could ever be considered a reasonable one. And here in this... I'm sorry.
If we got by that, your corporate practice argument, and the court decided to adopt Restatement 429, which is, after all, newer, more modern restatement from the agency, would you lose the case? Is a fact issue presented under that formulation?
No, Your Honor, if the restatement provision were adopted as written. However, in Texas, this court has never prevented any entity, much less a hospital, from relying on the truth simply because someone believed something different. Before a party is deprived of the right to establish the truth, and that's all Baptist wants to be able to do here, is establish and rely on the truth of the relationship it had with its physician, then this court has always required detrimental reliance, and 429 does not require reliance.
So would you lose if we recognize 429? Is there a fact issue on this record?
No, because again, I don't think that any belief that the patient could have had could be reasonable with the law the way it is in Texas. There is nothing in the affidavit where she testified that her belief was caused by anything Baptist did.
Wasn't this Court of Appeal, you say the law in Texas, wasn't this Court of Appeals just pretty much following their earlier decisions in terms of what a hospital does that would constitute a holy thing?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe so. The prior opinions adopted Section 267 of the Restatement of Agency.
But the way they read it.
Well, the way they applied the evidence to those elements, it was a bit loose. And
but you can talk about consistent Texas law, et cetera. But if I look at, if you're sitting on the San Antonio Court of Appeals and you're bound by your previous decision,
except
as far
that
as the holding here, how is it different from the two Smiths as far as the result in court reads?
Because under the two Smith opinion, the signs in the emergency room and the consent form would have meant that as a matter of law there could be no ostensible agency. Because it's not what the patient actually believes. It's what the patient should or should know. And if the patient should know that the doctor is not an employee, then ostensible agency can't be applied. And the whole theory is based on what the hospital does. And if all of the hospital's efforts are aimed at telling the patient what the relationship really is, then the hospital shouldn't be held liable on a fiction.
Any Any other questions? The court is ready to hear argument. We'll respond.
Mr. Carl Hayes and Mr. Oliver were heard and will present argument for the respondent. Mr. Hayes will open the first argument.
May it please the court. Ladies and gentlemen, the court, as this court can tell by the opinion from the Fourth Court of Appeal, the opinion is basically divided into two different areas. One deals with the fact issue that was found by the Court of Appeals, and the other deals with the policy issue that the Court of Appeals wrote on. With regard to the argument that we're going to present today, it's my intention to speak to the fact issue, that portion of the opinion that deals with the fact issue, and Mr. Hurd is going to speak on the policy issues that were addressed by the Fourth Court. In that regard, let me go straight to what Justice Phillips was speaking to, and I'll say two things with regard to that. First is that it is our position, of course, that if the court does adopt 429, that there are fact issues involved in the case and that Baptist would, in fact, lose because of the fact that, as the Fourth Court established, there was evidence that Rhea Sampson went to the hospital, did not look for a particular doctor, and that is uncontroversial. This case rises and falls on the affidavit testimony of Rhea Sampson. There are two affidavits which were presented by Ms. Sampson.
By that, do you mean that the summary judgment evidence by the hospitals would establish their position as a matter of law but for her controverting affidavit?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
So will you agree they carried their burden as a movement?
They carried their burden as a movement. The burden was on the, with regard to Rhea Sampson, the burden was on her to prove the ostensible agency issue because as the Fourth Court correctly noted and also noted in earlier opinions, this is an affirmative defense, and so it was incumbent upon Rhea Sampson to bring forth evidence to at least raise a fact issue on each of the elements of the ostensible agency or apparent agency theory. Now, in keeping along that same line of thought, what we are saying, however, is that the hospital does not establish as a matter of law that she could not have a reasonable belief. What the hospital wants to do is the hospital says, well, she could not have had a reasonable belief because there were signs posted and she signed these consent forms.
What else is the hospital supposed to do in order to dispel this reasonable belief?
Well, part
of it. In other words, how would a hospital communicate to a patient, this doctor doesn't work for us?
Well, see, that's what the Fourth Court says in the latter part of its opinion, that basically this is a situation which is so unique that there's probably not a circumstance where a hospital can actually wire around the problem, because what the Court of Appeals is noting is that what happened is they wrote their second Smith opinion or Baptist opinion, and the hospital then came forward with the trying to get around that by putting up signs, by doing this, and the Fourth Court correctly notes that, well, what's going to happen is we're going to keep having to pass on this question time after time as to whether they did enough to get beyond this issue. What we think, though, is it's a question for the jury to decide. If, based upon the fact that she signed these under the conditions she signed them in, and the fact that she says, I didn't see any signs, was it then reasonable?
Why is it a question for the jury if the Court of Appeals holds nothing you can do will lessen the holding in?
In that instance, if you go with what the Court of Appeals is saying as far as it being a there's nothing you can do, then it's a non-delegable duty and it would not be a question for the jury. If this court, however, says, no, we're not going to go that route, I think we end up in the situation then that the Fourth Court was trying to avoid, and it's a case-by-case analysis then of what a particular hospital does.
And so then what could you do?
One of the things that my esteemed co-counsel suggested in response to the trial court's question, because the trial court asked that same question, was that perhaps they could be running some kind of video in the emergency room, that they could go to further steps with as far as the consent process goes, because basically, as you saw in Ms. Sampson's affidavit, she doesn't even recall signing these. I mean, there's a problem, that Justice Spector noted, there's a problem with people coming into an emergency room. Most of the time, if they're bleeding or they're in some form of distress, they're in a situation where, essentially, they're not going to spend a lot of time looking at this form. And if you look at the form...
Well, Mr. Hayes, the law requires consent to medical treatment, regardless of whether it's in an emergency room or in some other context. For example, if a person's going to have surgery, the law requires that the patient's informed consent be obtained before surgery can be performed.
That's correct.
And you'd agree that a person facing major surgery is under stress.
They are usually, however, in it.
Well, but they are under stress. If I'm hospital and I'm about to undergo open heart surgery, would you say that I'm under stress?
Yes, I would
and
agree with
that.
And
yet the law requires that my informed consent be obtained.
That's
and
correct.
Typically obtained in writing with the risks written on the form, various disclaimers, and so on and so forth. There are very specific legal requirements for that.
That's correct.
And the law has consistently held that that consent meets the legal requirements for obtaining informed consent before surgery. Correct?
That's correct.
And we have a patient coming in. The law requires that consent be obtained. That's what happens in this circumstance.
The difference here is the difference that's noted by the Fourth Court is the emergency nature of the situation, because you have people that, albeit a person is under a stressful situation, you've got a situation where, as Ms. Sampson says here, she fully didn't understand or recognize the fact that she signed these.
Okay,
and she didn't
position,
go over.
Is your position then that she did not consent to medical treatment in the emergency room?
She consented to the treatment. She didn't understand the terms of that, because what they do in the consent form is they put in there, these people are independent contractors. And interestingly to note, I noticed this as I was reading through the opinions in the Smith case, one of the things that is relied upon by the Fourth Court in the Smith case is that when you read through the consent form is the provision that says all bills due to the hospital will be paid. In other words, they don't, and that language is still in the new consent form or the consent form that was used in that case. In other words, the hospital didn't change that, and it still gives the impression that the billing is going to come from the hospital itself.
So your position is that her signature on those two forms was effective consent for treatment, but not effective to disclaim the hospital's responsibility for the treatment provided by the doctor?
Yes. Absolutely.
What about when you're unconscious? Can you rely on anything you brought in unconscious to the emergency room in your treatment?
That was one of the arguments we presented to the trial court, and that's part of the problem here, because you've got a situation where somebody is coming in unconscious, or if they're in such pain that, I mean, they're going to sign anything that's put in front of them.
They're not capable of signing. They're brought in to the emergency room unconscious, and they are treated. What's their legal status with regard to a reasonable belief or reliance?
In that situation, my opinion is that they cannot form a reasonable belief. And that in that situation that there could not be any form of consent that they could give under those circumstances. Now, one thing that...
That wake-up letter, so I thought all emergency room doctors work for the hospital. Will that pass muster?
That's a unique situation, and quite frankly, at this point, I don't know whether that would suffice or not, because under the circumstances, the person didn't know what hospital they were being taken to. They didn't know the condition. It's a separate situation from what we have here.
Why should we treat the two patients differently? What's the element of reliance that justifies treating them differently?
The difference is there's a conscious decision on the part of Rhea Sampson to go to this particular hospital. And as Justice Abbott mentioned, it may be a situation where, although it's not in evidence in this case, the person sees the commercials on TV and they make a conscious decision to go to this particular hospital. That's where the difference is.
Well, did she say that she would not have allowed this physician to treat her had she understood he was not an employee of this hospital?
In her affidavit, no, she does not say that. She does say, however, that she went to the hospital specifically for the purpose of seeking help from that hospital. And that's where we're saying is the reliance aspect of it. She went to the hospital saying, I want to go to this hospital. And I noticed that my
time... Let me ask one follow-up question. Sure. Under Justice Owens' hypothetical that she just asked you, there'd be no liability on the part of the hospital because the unconscious patient cannot form a reasonable belief. But there is liability for the conscious patient who forms the reasonable belief that the hospital employs the doctor.
I think that would
right?
be the logic. That would be the logical conclusion.
Okay. So the patient who can't make a decision, is just out of luck.
I'll let Mr. Hurd answer that. It's an easy way out of it.
Did you have any time left to answer the question?
I was going to defer the rest of my time.
Okay. Thank you.
So what's the answer, Mr. Hurd?
As to the two situations of the patient who is in a coma or unconscious and the patient who comes in, the answer, Your Honor, is that we are trying to use principles of law that were developed in another area to an unrelated fact situation, and that leads to unreasonable and frustrating conclusions. Let me tell you why I'm saying that, okay?
Do you agree that the Court of Appeals' opinion is revolutionary? That is...
For Texas, it is. Ah. I mean, it's apparently the majority view in the United States.
But for Texas, it's
a care department.
You didn't give us any briefing to help us reach the conclusion of the majority view, and there was an amicus that gave some briefing to suggest maybe it's not.
Well, the Court of Appeals opinion cites a number of cases in other jurisdictions as part of the basis upon which it makes its decision.
If the briefing of the rural consortium of hospitals, if that has an appendix of 30 states, if that briefing is not correct, if you disagree with it, I would appreciate it.
I'm relying on the decision of the Court of Appeals on that issue. I disagree with the proposition that the majority of the states are contrary. What I'd like to just say real quickly are just a couple of little concepts that I think are a little confused. First of all, the law that applies to doctors who operate in a hospital as a general proposition is not what we're talking about. And that's what this release or consent form says. And as to those types of situations, the existing doctrines are sound. If I go to a hospital to be treated by my heart surgeon, who I have a contract with, perform surgery on me, the hospital should not be responsible for his conduct unless there is a ostensible agency reliance and all of that.
Well, what if he sends me to radiology, or sends you to radiology, and he doesn't know what doctors are on duty? The hospital has a separate contract with a radiology group, and they decide who you're going to see. Now, why should we apply a different rule in radiology than we do in the emergency room?
Well, in radiology, the doctor has a contractual relationship with the hospital, which makes the argument even stronger.
The ER physicians have the same contract?
No, they don't. Remember what this thing says that they signed. It doesn't say that they are independent contractors employed by Baptist Hospital. What it says is that they're contractors with the physician and patient, without any relationship with Baptist Hospital.
I don't understand why the radiologists are different from the ER doctors. They both have contracts.
In this aspect, I think that the radiologists are a responsibility of the hospital. I think that could possibly be released, by signature to an agreement.
Well, let's say I sign the same form when I come into the hospital. I go into ER, I sign one form, and that's good for all my treatments in the hospital. I'm treated in the ER. Later on, I move to a semi-private room, and my physician comes in and sends me to radiology.
No, it's not at all. I mean, the hospital, if your physician selects the radiologist.
He doesn't select the radiologist. He just says, you need an x-ray, you're going to radiology. He doesn't know who's going to be on call. That's the hospital has a radiology staff.
That radiologist can tell you that he doesn't like the radiology department in the hospital and make some other arrangements. And that happens. I mean, your physician is in control at that point, and your relationship is with him in that situation. If I could just read you this release, I further understand, I acknowledge and agree that Baptist Medical Center is not responsible for the judgment or conduct of any physician who treats me or provides a professional service to me, but rather each physician is an independent contractor who is self-employed and is not the agent, servant, or employee of the hospital. Traditionally, the whole law relating to non-liability for independent contractors has to do with independent contractors who contract with somebody else to provide the service to you. And that's not what we have here. So we don't have principles relating to a doctor who really is independent working with a patient who he knows with whom he forms a contract. And we do not have a principal agency relationship as that whole body of law has nothing to do with this situation. The question here is whether factually it is reasonable to believe, absent any contract between the patient and the doctor, that the doctor is a patient, is employed directly by the patient without any involvement of the hospital. That's what this release says. And the agency rules say principal and independent contractor, the independent contractor is not a servant unless there are some exceptions, such as ostensible agency. Those are two principles of law that we don't have anything to do with this case.
Do I understand you to say that what you think is unique about this agreement, it was requiring Ms. Sampson, when she came to the hospital and signed the document, what she was really doing was agreeing to the hospital's command to her that she contract independently with the ER doctor they were going to provide.
Right.
Then why, and assuming that that's the case, what is wrong with that? What is wrong with me agreeing with the hospital that I will hire the doctor directly?
There's nothing wrong with that if it's true, but it's not true. And that's why that analysis does not apply to this situation, because Mrs. Sampson came in the hospital in extreme pain. She said she went to the hospital. She didn't know any doctors. She spent 45 minutes filling out papers, she says, and answering questions. She doesn't even remember signing it. Then we're not even complaining about negligence on that transaction. Then she comes back the next day after being sent home with Benadryl and reports to the second physician, and the second physician says essentially the same thing as the first one, and discharged. Now, the hospital, I believe, there's a policy consideration as to whether the hospital should bear the responsibility for that decision. Because logically, the decision not to admit the patient in a critical condition is an economic decision as well as a medical decision. It's speculation that it played in part here. Of course, Mrs. Sampson is completely broke, never had any money, couldn't pay the bills, and then went to another hospital where Dr. Tom Glass, a noted expert in the field, saved her life. At that point, she was in septic shock. And that hospital bill can't be recovered because the doctor in this case, his insurance company went under. We're left with Baptist Hospital to sue. And now we have the barricades thrown up that she selected the physician.
I'm not sure. You said something just before Justine asked the question. You said ostensible agency doesn't have anything to do with this case. I didn't understand.
No. I'm saying the principles, the traditional principles of agency really don't have anything to do with this case. The idea that the principal is not responsible for the conduct of an independent contractor. is what I say doesn't apply to this case because it's not even under discussion. In fact, the hospital takes the position entirely that the doctor was not their independent contractor, but was the independent contractor of the patient. That's what the release says.
What's wrong in 30 words or less with their corporate practice argument?
There's no legitimate basis to it. It's an antiquated idea. There are all kinds of institutions, HMOs as well as hospitals.
But there's still a state. I mean, that may be. The legislature does have some language about hospitals, and then it has this whole other set of language about HMOs. What are we looking to do with that?
Well, I mean, the fact that they're committing a crime by doing something doesn't stop it from being tort and negligence. It doesn't prevent them from being responsible for it. I mean, I can hire somebody to do something that's unlawful for them to do, like kill someone, and they're still my agent, even though the contractor
does not become their agent simply because they don't put up a big enough neon sign telling the world that. I mean,
yeah.
The doctor's still not their agent. It's still a fiction.
So
they say, since the law is what it is, and in fact we weren't breaking the law, your client was deemed to have known that law, even though it's obscure.
Well, I mean, Your Honor,
we deem people know to pay their property taxes.
I understand. But the reality is that lawyers have difficulties with these concepts, obviously, or we wouldn't be here. And to expect Ray Sampson to grasp them is...
Where's your line? That's where I also lose sight of this. She's gone to that hospital, and does it really matter to her which doctor she gets? Is she going to walk out?
No, it doesn't matter to her what doctor she gets. What matters to her is that the hospital cure her, and through its doctors and so forth that it brings in, that it cure her, it take care of her, like it said on the television it was going to.
But she knew the real facts. I mean, you're just saying, well, she wasn't told that this doctor wasn't the hospital's employee. If she had cognitively or recognized it, known it, what would she have left the emergency room and gone somewhere else?
No, I don't think so. I think she would have probably, she had no choice. I mean, she can't even go to another hospital. You know, the patient is in an emergency situation, and they have to be dealt with. It's kind of like the question that you asked Mr. Hayes a minute ago. You know, what about the person who goes in and doesn't sign a form or whatever?
What's the answer to that question?
I think the answer is they consent to surgery by going into the hospital.
Can they sue the physician, the emergency room physician, sue the hospital for the failure of the emergency room physician?
Under the Court of Appeals opinion, you can.
So I'm asking you, should that be the law?
Yes, it should be.
Under an agency principle?
It should be the law under the principle of the enterprise of providing healing services, which is provided by the hospital.
How about the prohibition about doctors? I mean, hospitals cannot engage, or corporations cannot engage in the practice of medicine. I mean, what do we do with that?
You have a situation where the legislation and the statute has not been interpreted consistent with its clear meaning, because every hospital that operates an emergency room is in fact practicing medicine to the physicians it employs.
Mr. Hurd,
I suppose the enforcement mechanism is, you know, to arrest them or something.
Excuse me. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Sure.
If traditional agency principles do not govern the outcome of this case, what legal principles do?
The responsibility of the hospital for the action of its doctor.
And so you're advocating then that we adopt the Court of Appeals decision,
yes,
that there is a non-delegable duty on the part of a hospital.
That's correct.
With respect specifically to emergency medicine physicians.
Specifically with relation to emergency room physicians. It might logically develop later to radiologists, but I think that there are big differences. You know, in other types of professionals, I think there are differences. And that non-delegable duty does not extend to physicians who are actually employed by the patient.
Any other questions? Thank you, Governor.
Thank you very much.
A couple of things, Your Honor. First, with respect to the non-delegable duty, It's a fundamental prerequisite that this court has recognized over and over and over that before a duty is going to be placed on a person or an entity, there has to be some ability to prevent the harm. And until the legislature changes the Medical Practice Act, placing this non-delegable duty on hospitals would be making the hospitals liable without any ability to prevent the harm.
Because should they be more careful about who they credential?
Until this court's recent opinion, the duty with regard to credentialing was considered just part of the general duty of corporate care that a hospital has. And I suppose it still is. But it doesn't change the fact that that's direct corporate liability. It's not vicarious liability for the actions of someone else. And what the plaintiffs are advocating here is that a hospital not be liable because it did something wrong, but because it's simply vicariously liable, like an employer, like a principal of an agent or an ostensible agent, for the acts of someone else. And the reason why we're here really is because of what Mr. Hurd said towards the end of his argument, and that is that the doctor's insurance carrier became insolvent. This is a deep pocket issue. It's not a responsibility issue. And it should be, though, a responsibility issue, because here the Baptist did everything it could to be forthright with its patients.
Let me ask you a question. What is the hospital trying to do with an emergency room?
In order to get a license, you have to provide 24-hour emergency facilities. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to have an emergency room.
So every hospital is required by statute to have an emergency room.
Well, it's required to have emergency facilities with, I don't think they necessarily have to have an emergency room with a big sign, but that's a community service. And it's also, as one of the amicus briefs pointed out, it's generally a money-losing proposition for most hospitals.
But it's provided as a service. The emergency room is a service.
Yes, I suppose.
Is there a valid distinction between a hospital being an organization that provides a facility where a doctor can perform his or her job and the equipment and materials there, as opposed to an emergency room, which is not just a facility that doctors are able to use, but actually to enable the hospital to provide a service, which is not the facility, but actually the providing of emergency medical care. Is that a distinction between the historical notion of doctors and independent contractors and emergency room doctors as really integral to providing the service the community, the hospital is supposed to provide?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because there are certain medical specialties that have to practice their specialty within the four walls of a hospital. Even general surgeons, obstetricians, many specialties that few, if any, jurisdictions in this country have applied this doctrine to, they treat most of their patients in a hospital. The hospital provides the facilities. That's all it's doing with the emergency room, except that there are going to be some patients that will come there and won't have a particular physician to call, or will have called their physician who doesn't want to come and will say, go to the ER first. The physician may be busy, and they'll say, go to the ER first, and I'll meet you there. Or there's an emergency room physician there, he'll see you and call me. But the hospital provides the facilities for that emergency room physician to practice. It's a specialty. It's like radiology. It's like anesthesiology. Those are hospital-based practices. And nothing in the Court of Appeals opinion or, in fact, any of the opinions in other jurisdictions provide any rational, logical, legal analysis as to why this doctrine should be any different for ER physicians, radiologists, pathologists, anybody hospital-based, or in fact anybody that a patient sees in a hospital for the first time. And that would be an extension of liability to hospitals that hospitals can't control because they can't employ these physicians. There's no basis for it other than looking for another pocket. And quite frankly, with the statutory framework that this court is faced with, both the Medical Practice Act and 4590I, it would be against the public policy of the state to so broaden the liability of hospitals.
Any other questions? Thank you.
conclude the oral argument in this call and all the oral arguments this morning. These cases are submitted on briefs and oral arguments.